VentureCast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to episode 148 of the Burden of Command podcast. I'm your host, Earl Breon, and the Burden of Command podcast is a production of The Leadership Failings. To find out more about me and what I can do, visit leadershipphalanx.com. That's leadership, P-H-A-L-A-N-X.com. Now, one more quick reminder here before we get into today's guest that just two episodes after this, we're going to be changing the name of the show to the Responsible Leadership Podcast. Same great content, same great guests, same basic format, just some minor rebranding going on. So if you hear something a little bit different, starting with episode 151, you're still in the right place. Now, today's guest is Art Johnson. Art is CEO of Infinity Systems, Inc., a management consulting firm where he helps leaders identify and rectify organizational misalignment. Previously, he implemented a strategic plan to improve alignment at Medtronic, the world's largest medical technology company, enabling it to grow top-line revenue by 13% year-over-year in a flat market. His new book, and what we'll be talking about a lot today, is The Art of Alignment, a data-driven approach to lead aligned organizations. Now, this was a great conversation that Art and I had here, and we really focused on what alignment is, why it's valuable, and how your organization can achieve it. So without further ado, I'm going to get out of the way, let the stinger play, and let you get into this amazing interview with Art Johnson. Well, hello, Art, and welcome to the Burden of Command podcast.
Good morning.
Yeah, I'm excited to finally have this conversation. It's taken a little bit of finagling to get here, huh?
Yes, it has.
Well, I think it's going to be worth it. For the listeners, I mentioned in the pre-roll bio, we're going to be talking a bit about your book, The Art of Alignment, A Data-Driven Approach to Lead Aligned Organizations. But before we get into the book, I got to start you out where I start off all of my guests. When you hear the phrase burden of command, what does that mean to you?
Interesting. Well, I tell you, the first thing that comes to mind is when we think about leadership, I would have to say, Earl, that that comes with responsibility. And with that responsibility as leaders, we have to take it seriously. And by taking it seriously, meaning we have to make sure that we've truly taken the time to, one, clearly communicate what it is we are about as an organization, but also to inspect what you expect. And that requires some time, energy, and effort.
No, I like that a lot. And you hit on a lot of key elements that have been kind of a theme through some of the responses. And I like the way you packaged all that together. And it reflects very much so in the book. So let me start out for listeners here. When you use the term alignment, what are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the strength of harmony between strategy, structure, and culture. So when we talk about things like our mission statement, our vision statement as an organization, the degree to which employees have bought into that is paramount. So when we think about the strategy, we've defined directionally where we're trying to go. Are we structured in a way that we can get there? And do we have the right sort of culture so that not only are we able to achieve our objectives, but we're also able to sustain performance over time? So that's a more clinical answer, but that's where we have positioned that.
Yeah, no, I like that. I mean, sometimes clinical responses are the best and most appropriate response. And I like that. But the other thing I really like is you put the onus of alignment on leadership. Why is that the case?
So, Earl, I don't know if I'd solely put it on leadership, but I think it starts there.
Okay.
And what I mean by leaders, it's not just your stereotypical leader by title. There are other leaders within the organization that may not necessarily carry the title, but they carry a lot of weight and influence. They have a loyal following. When they congregate around the water cooler, there are people listening. And so it's important that we gather or kind of galvanize, if you will, all of these leaders and making sure that that we have one coherent, cohesive message as an organization as to who and what we're about. But the degree to which you can literally sew into the very fabric of the culture of that organization some of the ideals and ideologies is critical. And a lot of that comes with storytelling. And so leaders that are effective storytellers can get that message across. The beauty of that, Earl, is that these stories, sort of like the Bible, right? The concept of the story being able to carry out over the, you know, the test of time and people be able to, you know, harken back to experiences and whatnot that tie. And so I think that storyteller within the organization is not only good at illustrating what the expectation is, but at the same time, creating a narrative around what expectations are going forward.
Yeah, no, I like that. And I agree 100% with, you know, finding the right leaders that are in the right areas to make this happen and drive that kind of, well, the words you use, change in perspective, right? Because I think that's critical, especially, and we've seen this during COVID. You know, alignment is great, but alignment can't be rigid, right? It's got to kind of shift and change from time to time to meet the situation at hand.
You know, you're really touching on something there. And I don't know if alignment shifts, but I think leadership has to pivot like that. And I guess by leadership pivoting, in essence, there's elements of alignment and messaging and that sort of thing that have to morph as well. So what's coming to mind, Earl, specifically is the type of leadership that's required to get an organization from point A to point B. And sometimes it's a command and control sort of leadership, which, you know, there is a time for that. Sometimes it's more of the shepherd sort of leader, which is to say, you know, there are bellwether within our organization that are faster and in some instances more capable. So as that shepherd, all I want to do is make sure that I can get all the sheep going in that direction and get behind that bellwether and support what it is that they're bringing to the table. So it's a different sort of mentality. It's not the me sort of leader. It's the one that says, hey, let's get behind that. That makes a lot of sense. And making sure that you know, everybody's going in that same direction.
Yeah, no,
the really good leader is going to be able to ascertain what the need of the organization is. Does it call for that grabbing of the blowhorn and getting the message out? Or is it more subtle messaging? Or even is it time for a different person to step up into that leadership role and then get behind that particular person and or initiative?
Yeah, no, I like that too. You know, I think that's something that a lot of organizations, at least in my experience, is that's one of the things that a lot of organizations really do struggle with. Because, you know, I believe the same thing. I believe that anybody can be a great leader. I believe that it takes some time and effort and investment for, and more so for some people than others. Some people have some great natural talent. Some people are leaders in only one certain area, right? So I think we sing in harmony on that. But I'm curious from your experiences, because I get a lot of pushback on that saying, well, no, there's no way that employee X that works in silo B can be a leader. They just don't have that skill set. How do you get people to really understand the value of those types of employees and what they can bring to the table, especially when it comes to this shift in supporting the alignment of the organization?
So part of the leader's role is to clearly outline direction where we're trying to go, what it is we're trying to accomplish, and the method by which we might get there. But it's also to enlist the broader organization to identify other ways that we might accomplish our goals as an organization. Someone may come up with a wonderful idea that may not have been considered otherwise. So has the leader created a culture where people feel comfortable speaking up? They don't feel like they're at risk of reprisal for sharing their thoughts or ideas. And then they have a way and mechanism by which they can capture those thoughts and ideas and fully imbue them in the organization. So if all those pieces are there, then it's a function of making sure that you have the right kinds of people on the bus, so to speak. Those that have the ability to carry messages out, those that have creative ideas that they can bring to the table, those that just kind of fall in line with directionally where we're going, and those that can also lead. So by having a diverse group of people with different types of skill sets, all of which point toward the direction that the organization could and should be going, are things that that leader should be looking for. And then occasionally tapping certain individuals on the shoulder that carry the skill set necessary for the given challenge or task at hand, and then, you know, driving a sense of accountability within the organization through empowerment.
Mm. No, I like that. And you talked earlier about stories. As you were talking, what popped into my head was the kind of the infamous story. Some people say it actually happened. Some people say it's just another part of NASA lore. But there's kind of the infamous, you know, somebody asked a janitor at NASA what their job was, and they said, "I'm sending people to the moon." And you know, the obviously they're a janitor. They're there to empty trash cans and that sort of stuff. But to that individual in that story, their job was to send people to the moon, just like the high-level engineer that was working on rockets and things like that. And I think if I'm following you, that's kind of that alignment and that using your resources that you're talking about, right?
Absolutely. So the degree to which we can take and push decision-making down into the organization, get people excited about the mission and vision and how they contribute to it, get them to see line of sight how their contribution contributes brought to the broader organization, so that when we celebrate our successes, they can, you know, stand up a little bit taller or stick their chest out a little bit more and have a sense of pride knowing that they contributed to it in whatever capacity. And the degree to which we can empower these individuals and get them excited and get them to drop the oars in the water is the term that we use frequently in this alignment space, is paramount to creating the sort of energy that not only propels an organization to achieve its objectives, but it creates a culture that's sustainable over time.
Yeah, and that's magic, right? That's the magic that everybody should be chasing.
It is. You know, we see it all the time, you know, whether it's in a corporate setting, any organization. We see it in sports. We see it even in orchestras. Like, you know, I think about like the bolero and the ability to perform that. There aren't a ton of orchestras around the world that can even do it. But the amount of focus and attention and alignment that's required to pull it off is something to behold. But when it happens, boy, is it something special. And, you know, we all strive for that. But there are components that we have to be paying particular attention to that I outline in my book, The Art of Alignment, and we get at each and every one of them, so that now we can figure out if we're not really reaching optimal performance, we can start looking at the constructs that ultimately can get us there and figure out where we're falling a little bit short, tweak those things, and get ourselves back on track.
No, I love it. Well, I think that's a great segue into talking about these pillars. Now, obviously, we're not going to have time to get in to every single one of these nine pillars here. And listeners, that just means that you're going to have to go out and buy a copy of The Art of Alignment to get the rest of that. But let's dive into those. Does that sound good?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So the first pillar, and I really like this, is mission and vision. Now, you've talked about that already. Some people see those things as being the same exact thing. So how are they different?
So the main difference is that the mission defines what it is that we're about as an organization. The vision describes what the world will look like if we're able to achieve it.
Mm.
So pretty straightforward. I mean, it's not the sexiest description, but that's the one that we use.
Yeah, well, no, and I like that, and I like simple. And one of the other things you talk about in the book is a clear and simple mission. And I'm going to assume just by that and some of the things in the book that you've ran into some organizations where that mission is overly complicated, but there's some beauty in simplification, right?
There is, because what it allows everyone in the organization to do is to be able to recite it, keep it front and center, bring it into each and every one of the staff meetings, and make sure that it's something that is reflected throughout, whether it's in a employee evaluation, whether it's in a job description, whatever. We should be clear on directionally where we're trying to go as an organization, and specifically what we're about. And so with that, we save ourselves a lot of mishires. So if it's clear in the interview process who we are and what we're all about, a person that's interviewing for that particular job or to come into that particular organization can quickly decide, is this a fit or not? And the question should be geared more toward that. And so the degree to which we get really effective in that, then we have fewer mishires. And then the training process is a lot easier because you have a person that's fully bought into directly where the organization's going and what it's about, and they can bring their full authentic self because it is aligned with who and what they're about. And so that's where this really starts to get kind of interesting and exciting.
Oh, no, I love that. And I love the fact that you brought in the hiring process, because that's one of the things that I've done some work in is working on unconscious biases and things like that in the hiring process. And one of the exercises I have folks go through, and it sounds very similar to kind of what you're talking about here, is before you look at anything, write out a few sentences that identify the strongest candidate. And then we go through and we talk about all the different things that weigh into the decision-making process. You know, the obvious ones, the age, race, sex, religion. But then we talk about how attractive the person is. You know, some of the affective type things. How do they look? Are they tall? Are they skinny? All those sorts of things, right? And then at the very end of it, I ask them to go back and look at those sentences. And how many of those mention age, race, sex, religion, height, weight, any of that? And the answer is none of them, right? But so we know what we want on one hand, but we're not aware as we go through the process of these things that come in and kind of filter our decision making that really don't have any bearing on the process. And this mission and vision and having it clearly simplified seems like a great mechanism to help with that, right?
It does, Earl. You know, and I spoke at Villanova University. Oh, this has been 6-7 years ago, to a graduate class of, it must have been close to 50 students. And so you've got students that are middle management up through senior management. And so I asked the question. I pulled out a $100 bill and I said, I'll give this $100 bill to anyone in here who can recite their mission statement without looking it up. And there were only two that tried, and one of them got close. The other one did not. And, but the one that got close still did not achieve hit the target. So that just shows you that throughout corporate America, throughout, organizations, whether it's public or private, people struggle with that. And so the degree to which we can simplify it so that it doesn't leave the minds of the individuals, we have now, you know, taken that first step to making sure that everyone's fully on board.
Mm. No, I like it. And I think the other thing that you mentioned there, and I really want to highlight, because I think this is something that is extremely valuable for folks to take away from this, is that oftentimes we look at hiring through the lens of the organization doing the hiring, But what I liked about what you said there was you mentioned a lot about the applicant. And I think people fail to realize that the hiring process, especially the interview process, is just as much about the applicant figuring out if this organization is a good fit for them as it is for the organization figuring out if the applicant works for them, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it's both ways, Earl, right? So part of the responsibility is on the applicant to make sure that, hey, you know, I'm actually going to a place that espouses my values and will allow me to hopefully achieve my aspirational goals. But in the same token, the organization as well has to make sure that they're asking the right sorts of questions to really ascertain whether or not we have the right candidate for the culture that we're trying to create. And so that's not the easiest thing. And we're seeing that play out time and time again, like in places like law enforcement, one of the sectors that we've been serving for some time now.
Yeah, no, 100%. Well, that ties into the next pillar quite nicely, because we talk about leadership and you talk about how authenticity and leading by example are important. And those are things, you know, as a former active duty Marine, those are things that are near and dear to my heart, because those were foundations of Marine Corps leadership. But I think that's really it, right? Is what you just said, the alignment, we'll come back to your word, the alignment of what you say and what you do. And I think this is my opinion. I don't know if you share it or not, but in the environment we're in right now, where we're talking about this great resignation that's going on, I think that's really at the root of it, right? Is people want to say, well, you know, hey, folks are getting free money. Of course they don't want to work. But I don't think people are saying they don't want to work. I think people are actually saying, hey, you're misaligned. I don't want to work for you.
You know, I think each situation has its own items that are coming into play, and so each one is different. You know, I've got examples on both sides of that equation, right? One that, you know, there are individuals that flat out don't, but then to your point, you're right. I don't really want to work for you. And unfortunately, or fortunately, we have people that are uncomfortable having those difficult conversations and letting them know in the exit interview, this is really the reason why I'm not coming back to work, or the reason why I quit, or the reason why I, you know, want to work from home, or whatever it may be. And so, so for your extroverts that are able to articulate those things and are comfortable, then we get that good feedback. But many times our best talent walks out the door. We have no idea why it happened. And so, but it oftentimes, to your point, Earl, it is attributable to who they're working for. More people leave not for another job as much as they do to get away from the boss that they have.
Yeah. No, and I think that's, you know, reading through the book, maybe I've learned a few things here, but I think that's kind of the point, right, is with alignment here, right, and they don't have to be those big things that we see a lot of media attention on, again, going back to age, race, sex, religion, things like that. But if you're a science-based company and you don't support science, people don't want to work for the company anymore. If you are a philanthropic organization and you're operating more capitalistic than philanthropic, people don't work for that organization anymore. This alignment that you talk about, whatever dimension it's on, is really the driving factor, right?
Yes, yes. And the degree to which we can get true alignment in our organization, we can begin to expect voluntary turnover to decrease. When we think about why this alignment thing is so important, which I would imagine we're going to talk about here, and just to get right into it, is an aligned organization performs better than a misaligned organization. So part of the exercise here is to figure out, and we have, that's what Orgametrics is all about, is the ability to measure alignment. And in measuring it, we can quickly ascertain where we stand relative to alignment. So the higher my orgometric score, the more aligned my organization is. If I find it to be misaligned, now I can begin to unpack, all right, what's driving the misalignment within, and figure out, all right, do we have an accountability issue? Do we have a communication challenge? What is it that's driving this misalignment? And oh, by the way, where is it taking place? Is it taking place in a certain geographical area within the organization? Or is it taking place with a certain group of people within the organization? And there's some interesting things that have come from that. What I learned in leading some of the organizations I've run is that the farther you get away from headquarters, the message starts to get a little weaker. So the communication isn't quite as strong, and therefore we become a misaligned entity or organization. The other thing that we also found is that people within the organization that felt most disenfranchised were the ones that were misaligned as well. They felt, you'd hear statements like, well, that's their mission statement, or that's their vision, you know, not mine. And so those are misaligned kind of comments. And so part of that, again, if I feel disenfranchised for whatever reason, like you said, it could be race, gender, sexual orientation, religion, doesn't matter. It's going to be more difficult for me to become an aligned individual. But if we become a culture of inclusivity, that begins to mitigate a lot of that.
Mm. No, I love what you said there. I mean, because it's 100% true. Obviously, I agree with that. I'm very curious, as you're doing this data gathering, how often do you run into, when you first start working with an organization, their expectations are that they are 100% in alignment, and then your data tells them they're nowhere near?
You know, first of all, that is more often the case than not. People are more misaligned than they think they are. And what we're learning is that the misalignment starts at the leadership team level. So in other words, when we've gone out to measure alignment within an organization, what we've learned is about 74% of the most senior leaders of the organization, like the ones that report directly to the CEO or the superintendent, or you name whoever the top person is, those direct reports are 74% aligned, which means that there's 26% on average misalignment. And when they go to cascade the message throughout the organization, misalignment doesn't breed alignment. It breeds more misalignment. So as you get further down, that alignment score gets lower and lower, so that by the time you get to the individual contributor level, we're in the teens. And so that's why it's critical that leadership team is fully on the same page. And when we leave these doors from this meeting, establishing who it is that we are and what it is that we're going to be and what the world's going to look like based on that, we need to go out of one accord. And so if you have an issue in this meeting, raise it now. Let's get it worked out. Because like I said, when we walk out of here, we are on the same page. And so when I speak to groups and particularly leadership teams, you know, of course, we're using the book as kind of the backdrop, but the main thrust of the conversations are, how do we get everybody on the same page? And the degree to which we can do that and then be effective at cascading the message to the next level. And that's what I meant early on when I mentioned inspecting what we expect. We're expecting alignment. So how do we inspect that? So part of it is through measurement, but also a large part of it is taking the time to get to know the players on the team and making sure that not only are the expectations clear to them, but the ways by which we recognize their work and evaluate their performance is consistent with what it is that we expect and where we're trying to go as an overall organization.
Mm. No, and I love what you said there. And I want to kind of give a slightly different example here, just because I know I've got a lot of veterans that listen to the show as well, and they'll identify with this. But anybody who's done any orienteering will get it, right? But what you said about alignment. So, you know, if you're off by a degree on a compass, after 100 yards, you're off by about 5 feet, right? So that's not that bad. You can correct that pretty easy. After a mile, you're looking somewhere between 90 to 100 feet. But if you were to circumnavigate the globe, you would be 500 miles away from where you started. And that's what you're talking about there with the alignment. The further that propagates away from, you said headquarters, we'll use that word, the further off the entire organization gets. And that's really your point there, right?
Absolutely. You know, and in the telecommunication space, we call that attenuation, which is the longer that line is, you know, we start to get distortion and the message isn't as clear by the time it gets to the furthest point away. So it's incumbent upon the leaders to make sure that we put what's called repeaters out there, which strengthen the signal as we send it longer distances and minimize the distortion. You know, Earl, my father was a drill sergeant in the Army.
Nice.
MP over in Korea. And he said what he meant and meant what he said. And I can recall as a kid, you know, this is early on alignment for ART, bringing the car in late, one of my first times out with the car. He wanted home by 11 and I got in about like 11:05. And the old drill sergeant met me at the door. And I could tell by the look on his face that there was extreme disappointment. And all he did is ask me, are we ever going to have this problem again? Crystal clear as to what the expectations were. I'll tell you another quick one too. Same guy, my father. I finished cutting the grass. And afterwards, he comes out to just kind of see how, you know, inspect the work. You know, again, we're inspecting what we expect. And there's a strip that I had missed. And he looked at me and he said, Art, is this your best work? So I see the strip and I say, no, it's not my best work. He asked me one more question. He said, when do you think we'll see your best work? So within about 2 seconds, I got that lawnmower fired back up again and finished off the job. But the message was clear, you know, the expectations were clear, and alignment began early in my life. Over my professional career, I just began the process of identifying the components of it and effectively measuring it. So no, this is, I appreciate the example you used of the military, because it's very much a part of how I grew up.
Yeah, well, no, I love it. And this is, so a couple of the other pillars are communication and accountability, and that's really what we were just talking about. And what I like about that, and where this ties into the next question I want to ask, because I asked about alignment being out of proportion, but I'm assuming that you find something similar with communication itself, like organizations feel they communicate better than they really do, right?
Yeah, they do, you know. And so the question is the message getting to the people? In other words, certain leaders are better at cascading the message than others. So part of this is to measure that. We want to find out, hey, which parts of the organization, you know, don't understand the mission? What parts of the organization can't see the correlation between their day-to-day activities and the mission? And that's a function of, again, effective communication. But another aspect of it is communication within the organization bidirectional. I mean, if we're running a paramilitary organization, you're right, then it's command and control, right? Push the message out, do what I say. But we need feedback loops, Earl. We got to have, you know, there's things that are happening out there that that we may not, sitting in our ivory tower, be aware of. Have we installed the right kind of feedback loops so that we can get fast, accurate information relative to the ever-changing marketplace? And so the really strong communication organizations that are effective at communicating have these feedback loops.
Yeah, no, and here's the dirty little secret Hollywood doesn't want you to know, because of how they make every military movie ever made, basically, is that command and control really doesn't work in the military either. Like as you mentioned, there are certain times when it has a role, right? But those aren't necessarily leadership times. Those are more management times. But everything you just said, all of these things still hold true. That's why, I guess, Hollywood brushes up against it. That's why you hear that call and response, right? Some old submarine movie, you know, make depth 100 feet. Aye, make depth 100 feet, sir. It's what you just said, that feedback loop to keep the conversation going. And so I agree with you 100% on this, and especially the bi-directional piece. I was working with an organization once, and we did a survey, and we broke it out for management and bargaining unit. And the bargaining unit's response was, I really wish management would talk to us more. And the number one response from management was, I really wish the bargaining unit would talk to us more. They both wanted the same thing, right? They just didn't know that they both wanted the same thing. And how often does that happen, right?
Right. Yeah. More frequently than we would like.
So how do we overcome? So basically what we're talking about here is something called optimism bias, right? We always think that we're doing a little bit better than we are, no matter what the subject is. We always think our breath smells better than it is. We always think that we're losing weight faster than we really are. All of these things, right? How do we overcome that optimism bias when it comes to alignment and communication?
Boy, that's a good question. First of all, it's through having conversations with individuals within the organization, interviewing, opportunities for skip level interviews, setting aside the time to just get to know where everybody's coming from. I think these create opportunities for dialogue and feedback. And a better understanding of, or I should say, a better mechanism by which we can get folks on the same page.
I agree. I love it. It's going back to the earlier discussion about leadership. You really got to model that example, right? If you want communication, you got to communicate. So one of the other pillars there that we talk about is empowerment. When you're talking about empowerment here, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about pushing decision-making down in the organization. If the belief is that the individual contributors of the organization, sometimes that could be the sales force, are closest to the customer, are closest to what's going on in the marketplace, have we pushed decision-making down as far as we possibly can so that they have the autonomy to make the right decision at the right time? They have the most information of anybody. And if we've done a good job of fully empowering them to delight our customers or delight those that we are serving, then at that point in time, we should get the most positive outcomes if they're following our mission or if they're following the mission and vision of the organization. So if we're clear on what that is, we've pushed decision-making down, we should get better, faster decisions. The beauty of this, Earl, is that now we have also, in the same turn, created a greater sense of accountability because there is no finger-pointing. I'm not doing what you told me to do. I'm doing what I believe to be the right thing for the situation. And so if we're looking at the outcome of that work, who's the most accountable individual? It's the individual making that decision. The fact that they're able to do that is liberating. So I don't know if you've ever read this book called Zap. It's the lightning of empowerment. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, when an employee meets with an employer, does the employee leave that conversation with more energy than they came with? So in other words, if I go to meet with my boss and I have a conversation and that conversation saps me of my energy, because I have not been empowered to make my own decisions, I'm probably going to begin to think about doing something else. But if in turn I've actually been empowered to do the work that I do, then the excitement of going back and doing that with the fervor and intensity and bringing my full self to the job is definitely in play. I'm going to do not only my best work, but when you recognize my work, it's going to be genuine. Because it wasn't me just carrying out what it is you wanted. It's me getting a chance to use my creativity, use my capabilities, use my brain power to accomplish what we've set out to do. And then the recognition is much more meaningful.
Mm. No, and I love that again. And you know, being having a drill sergeant as a father, you may have heard this before. I don't know. But there's an infamous quote by Patton, and I'm going to paraphrase it. But keep in mind, this is a guy that they refer to as blood and guts, right? He didn't have exactly a warm, fuzzy personality. But he said, don't tell people what to do. Tell them what needs to be done and get out of their way and let them dazzle you with their brilliance. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about here, right?
That's exactly it. That is exactly it. And so that's for the person that is, you know, the term control freak is overused. But for the person that embodies this, that sort of ideology, they struggle with that. And those aren't going to be the most effective leaders because they're incapable of employing the Tom Sawyer approach, which, you know, we've read that literary work of Mark Twain. But how do we get this fence painted if we have to do it all by ourselves? It's going to take us an entire summer. But if we can enlist the help and support of others around and empower those around us, we put ourselves in a place where we can get this done quickly. And so it's critical that we grasp this concept and really try to embody it in a way that allows the organization to perform as well as it can.
Well, and I would say not only that, but the final product is almost always better when you do this than it would be if you just had do it textbook my way, right?
Right. Right. No, exactly. But if you're trying to inject energy into your organization, it's there's no faster way to do it than pushing decision making down. You know, people feel energized and liberated based on just that alone.
No, I love it. I love it. So going past the pillars here, again, listeners, there's more pillars. You need to get the book and you can find out what they all are. But you talk about something in the book, and I love this term, but it's the crescendo effect. So what is the crescendo effect?
So, you know, we've got all these pillars like you're talking about. And part of the exercise here is to look at each one and say, boy, you know, we sure got to get our communication together, or we need better leaders within our organization. The crescendo is how these things play off of each other. So, for instance, if we've got better leadership, we communicate more effectively, we get better feedback loops, it drives a greater sense of creativity, we've pushed decision-making down, the accountability goes up, all of these elements begin to come together and create what I call that crescendo effect, which allows us it's no longer additive, it's more exponential in terms of our ability to perform. Medtronic was a prime example of that. We went and identified where we as an organization, as a sales organization, were falling short. When we addressed those things, we got the benefit of that crescendo effect. Things started happening and we became aware of things that would otherwise not have been readily accessible or identifiable. And by identifying these things and addressing them as we go, and again, pushing these decisions down in the organization, we really got some significant lift. And that's where we were able to grow top line revenue 13% year over year in a flat market. And, you know, Earl, as a market leader, that is very difficult to do. So that's something that I will always be excited about and an example I will always use. But again, it's just a matter of really trying to get that crescendo effect of all these elements, these nine pillars kind of coming together and making it an exponential experience versus just additive.
Oh, I love that. I love that. You know, and folks, we've been chatting here for about 40 minutes or so, and I promise you, we've only touched on about half of the book. That's how much meat there is in this book. But before we do anything else, I got to ask you one other question here. From the book, you talk about the paradox of the smart person. What is that about?
Well, you know, oftentimes, you know, people are promoted because they are perceived to be smart, and many times they are. But sometimes that smartness can get in the way. In other words, if you ever ask a smart person a question, they feel compelled to answer it. Well, Earl, sometimes it's better not to answer the question. And I can recall, you know, employees coming into my office asking me, hey, Art, can I do this? Well, I know the answer, right? Or at least I know my answer.
Right.
But instead of answering the question, I'd say, you know, Bob, I don't know. Can you?
And then Bob would say, well, I know, I just want to know if this is something that I can do. And I'd say, well, you know, do you think it's the right thing to do? Well, yeah. Okay. Well, can you tell me what's standing in your way from moving forward then? Right. Just completely pushing. But the minute I answer the question, I have killed all creativity, because now as the boss, we're going to do what the boss says, the kind of culture that we're in. But if we as leaders can just not have to be the smartest person in the room and answer all the questions, we get more ideas that bubble up and we get more options by which we can choose. There's always an opportunity for you to share your thoughts, views, and opinions. But if you can just bite your tongue for a second as a leader, right, that you've got the title, get over yourself, and let's hear what some of the other ideas that might potentially take us further faster.
I love that. I do a lot of work with cognitive diversity, and that's the one thing that is the hardest thing for me to get through leaders' heads is what you just said. And I love the way you put it. If you go first, you've killed all creativity, because people are going to gravitate towards your solution instead of thinking on their own. And that is an important piece that I really wish that a lot more leaders could understand. And it's not that you're doing anything bad. It's just by virtue of your position, people are going to want to agree or align. And I know we're talking about alignment in a positive way, but here in some ways, it's kind of a negative. People are going to want to align as closely as possible with your solution, if for no other reason than to try to curry favor, right?
That's so true. That's so true. And the leader can stop all that by saying, hey, you know what? I don't know. And by the way, sometimes saying, you know, I don't know, shows a sense of humility. Mm-hmm. And what that drives in the organization is more risk-taking. And more risk-taking leads to greater creativity. Greater creativity leads to innovation. You know, and I could go on and on. So we as leaders have an opportunity to really get the best and the most out of our employees, sometimes by just being quiet.
I love that. Well, Art, I want to be cognizant of your time here. We've been chatting for about 45 minutes or so, and I don't know about you, but this has just been an outstanding conversation.
Earl, I would have to agree with you. I think you've done a great job of not only capturing the essence of what the art of alignment is all about, the excitement of the work that we've done. We are very pleased as, you know, being a Wall Street Journal bestseller. But in the same token, though, we think this is a mechanism by which leaders and those that espouse to be leaders can look at an organization and say, you know, there are ways to really drive the highest levels of performance, but we got to take the time to inspect what we expect.
100% agree. Now, again, as I mentioned, we left a lot of meat on the bone here. So thank you very much for those comments, considering how much we have left to talk about if we had an infinite time here, but we don't. So with that in mind, is there any piece of the book that we didn't get a chance to cover that you really want to leave listeners with?
You know, it's not as much from the book. It's really what came since the book, right? So in the process of writing the book, and it took some time to do, we quickly learned that by measuring organizational alignment, we were also measuring misalignment. And I alluded to the fact that those that are most feel most marginalized are those that oftentimes are most misaligned. And by doing that work, what we did was pivoted to this idea of, if alignment is truly the is kind of this concept of leveraging strategy, structure, and culture, the strength of harmony between the three, that cultural aspect is what drives sustainability. And so we began to even take a deeper dive in there. So not only measuring alignment, but now measuring that cultural aspect of it, so that once we become aligned, it is something that will stand the test of time. And that cultural aspect took us right into the space of measuring what we call cultural competency. And I heard you mention unconscious bias a moment ago, but by measuring this cultural competency, we can begin to sustain performance over time as that equimetric score goes up. So that's another tool of measurement. Stay tuned for, you know, future writings on that. but we are able to measure cultural competency as well, and it's some exciting stuff. So it's just a quick commercial, shameless in some ways, but exciting in others.
Well, I'm excited to hear that, and don't worry about it because I love it. And when that comes out, when you're ready to unveil that, you've got an open invitation to come back on the show.
Earl, I really appreciate it.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Well, so let's say we've won over some folks, which I know we have. They want to get a copy of the book. They want to find out more about you and your organization and what services you offer. What's a good place for them to go look for that information?
So Orgametrics, Orgametrics.net. And then the book can be purchased wherever you get your books, whether it's Barnes & Noble or through Amazon.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Well, Art, thank you very much for spending the time with me and my listeners today. I really appreciate the conversation we had, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Earl, thanks for the flexibility, and nice work on your part as well.
Oh, thank you very much. And listeners, thank you very much for being with us and spending the time with us. Make sure you go and visit Art's website. That'll be in the links in the show notes, so you can just click and get there. Grab a copy of the book. And do what you guys do best. Make sure you share, rate, review, and get this show out there so Art can get his message spread further and make more of an impact the way he and his organization want to do. If you have any comments or questions or concerns for me, you can reach out at burden.command@gmail.com. That's burden.command@gmail.com. Thank you for your time. Appreciate everything you do. And I look forward to speaking with you all again in the next episode.
Welcome to Ringside with Ray and Prince. My name is Ray Leonard Jr.
Oh, we got this chair.
No, that's just my dad.
My name is Prince Daniels Jr.
Daniels again with a big home touchdown.
On this show, we come to humanize
athletes, entertainers, business executives. We're going to see what makes them tick.
Tuesdays, 10 a.m. Pacific time on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll see you there. Peace. Power.
Electric Acid.
Miles, are you ready to record our promo for season 2 of the Wanna Bet podcast?
David, have you ever seen a grown man naked?
Miles, we're not here to quote lines from Airplane. We're here to tell people that season 2 starts August 18th.
But I like Airplane.
I know you do, but Wanna Bet is a sports betting podcast. Each week we bet $1,000 on the NFL teams and games that we love.
Well, that sounds like fun.
It is fun. And last year you picked over 60% of your games correctly.
How'd you do?
We're not talking about that. We are telling people that they can find us every Friday. So no more movie quotes.
Roger, roger.
Electric Acid. Electric Acid.